charging up to $400 million in state and federal income tax. From your piece, you write, side transferred Trip Light to the Marble Freedom Trust, a nonprofit that's exempt from income tax, federal income tax, before electronics company was sold. As a result, lawyers say he avoided up to $400 million in state and federal income tax, preserving those funds for Leo's new operation.
Yeah. So Barry Side is quite old. He's 90 years old, and so he actually attended the University of Chicago as back right around at the start of the Chicago School. We do understand that he's a pretty big fan of Milton Friedman, but this transaction was all structured in a way that really gamed the rules around donations to nonprofits donating appreciated property. If he had sold this company for $1.6 billion, he probably would have owed up to $400 million. By structuring it this way, by having the trust sell the nonprofit or trust sell the company, saved him a pretty hefty tax bill, and it also then really preserved the amount of money that would be available for Leonard Leo's new group. And I should stress that this money all came after his network and Leo had successfully remade the Supreme Court, building a conservative supermajority there. So this is all money that can really be used towards the future, towards building and expanding the conservative movement.
We have 5 seconds. Why do you think it's critical the public know?
I mean, we think that the public should know, all of these donations, all donations.
Andrew
to dark
Paris,
money
we're
groups.
Gonna leave it there. Thank you so much. We'll link to your piece.
Meow, meow. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society concert series starting Saturday, September 17th with singer-songwriter Tim Grimm. Folk Music Series of 9 Saturday concerts starts September 17th and continues through May of 2023 at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele. Season tickets are now available. Ticket information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
Hi, this is Pat Matheny. You're listening to Radio KBOO.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, Race the Revolution, the United States and Cuba during slavery and Jim Crow with Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. It's primary day today in Florida and New York State. In Florida, Democrats are voting to decide who will take on Republican Governor Ron DeSantis in November's general election. And in New York, congressional primaries include a race between two powerful Democratic committee chairs, Carolyn Maloney and Jerry Nadler, who will face each other because of redistricting. More from Public News Service's Mary Sherman.
Former Republican governor-turned-Democrat Charlie Crist takes on Florida Agricultural Commissioner Nikki Fried in the state's Democratic gubernatorial primary today.
Vote like your life depends on it, because it actually does.
You have a choice. We can keep losing, or we can try something new.
Crist is ahead of Fried in recent polling. Whoever advances will face Republican incumbent Ron DeSantis, a top GOP name for the 2024 presidential race. In New York, voters will weigh in on congressional and state Senate seats. Vacancies in the House due to retirements, resignations, and campaigns for higher office have resulted in numerous candidates running in congressional races. And due to redistricting, a new Manhattan area seat has two Democratic incumbents facing off, Representative Carolyn Maloney and Representative Jerry Nadler. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Meanwhile, in Oklahoma, election watchers will be focused today on the race for retiring U.S. Senator Jim Inhofe's seat. Former Oklahoma Speaker of the House T.W. Shannon and Marquain Mullen are the last two Republican candidates on the ballot after a crowded field entered the June primary. The winner will face former Democratic U.S. Congresswoman Kendra Horn in November. Lawyers for former President Trump are requesting that a federal judge appoint a neutral special master to preempt the inspection of documents recovered from his Florida residence. This would prevent the FBI from continuing to review the documents for now, the attorneys asserted Monday in their first court filing since the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago 2 weeks ago, that the sets of documents taken from the resort were, quote, presumptively covered by executive privilege. They say the matter has captured the attention of the American public, and safeguards are needed to protect Trump's constitutional rights. Heavy rains in the Dallas-Fort Worth area are causing streets to flood and submerging vehicles as officials warn motorists to stay off the roads. The National Weather Service says the area is pretty much ground zero for the heaviest rain overnight. The Weather Service says over 9 inches of rain fell at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport over 24 hours, ending at midday yesterday. At least one fatality has been blamed on the downpour, as emergency officials say they've responded to dozens of locations with high water on the roads. Meanwhile, thousands have been evacuated from flood-hit areas in India and Pakistan, and millions have been affected in both countries. Officials warn the death toll could continue to climb. More from Future Story News' Ishan Garg.
Incessant rains and flash floods have robbed tens of thousands of their homes and livelihoods in Pakistan. Authorities say it's the worst flood Punjab and Balochistan provinces have experienced in a long time. Estimates say more than 780 people may have lost their lives in Pakistan just this year. And across the border in India, things aren't much different either. More than 40 people have lost their lives in a flash flood in the past 2 days. Thousands are being moved to safety, but the weather office says more rain could be incoming. Earlier, South Asia was projected to get less than average rain. But experts say climate change is worsening extreme weather patterns, and it could continue affecting millions in the future as well. Ishan Garg, New Delhi.
A senior EU official has recommended that the 27-member bloc should consider training Ukrainian troops to fight Russian invaders. The recommendation comes as Ukraine celebrates its Independence Day. Trent Murray reports from Berlin.
The European Union's top diplomat said that the bloc should consider a military training program for Ukrainian soldiers. Joseph Borrell, speaking at a university seminar in Santander, Spain, said, quote, the EU should look at efforts not only in terms of material supplies, but also in terms of training, as well as help in organising the armed forces. While the EU doesn't have its own standing army, it does have a defence agency which facilitates integration between member states within the EU's common security and defence bloc. Any military training mission led by the EU would need sign-off from all 27 member countries, a box that could be difficult to tick, given some countries like Hungary have said the EU should not get involved in the war in Ukraine.
And that's Trent Murray in Berlin, and I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
That was our news headlines. I recently had a conversation with Dr. Gerald Horn about his latest book, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. First, let me tell you a bit about Dr. Horn. He holds the Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. Dr. Horn has published over 30 books, including The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the USA, Black Revolutionary William Patterson, and the Globalization of the African American Freedom Struggle. His latest book, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. Dr. Horn's extensive research and writings have addressed issues of racism in the areas of civil rights, labor, politics, war, international relations, as well as the film industry. He specializes in shedding light on underrepresented and misrepresented struggles of humanity for social justice, such as struggles against imperialism, colonialism, communism, fascism, and racism. Dr. Horn is the former executive director of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. He received his PhD in history from Columbia University, his law degree from the University of California, Berkeley, and his bachelor's degree from Princeton University. Dr. Horn, welcome back.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Horn, I was really impressed and delighted to see that you have yet again another new book coming out. And as I've told you before, you write faster than I could read. What I'd like to do now is to just share with our audience what Henry Louis Gates, Jr. of Harvard University, he's the Alphonse Fletcher University professor at Harvard, had to say about your new book. Quote, in his path-breaking book, Gerald Horn reveals how the histories of Cuba and the United States, from the slave trade to Jim Crow and the Cold War, have always been closer and more turbulent than the 90 miles separating them across the Straits of Florida. Indeed, one cannot possibly understand the journey from bondage to freedom in America without wrestling with its consequences for the people of African descent in Cuba. Their story is our story. And thanks to Horn, we can now study its flow in a single and profound narrative. Dr. Horn, that is something coming from Henry Louis Gates, but Tom Hayden, Ishmael Reed, and others have also well reviewed this book. So what I'd like to do is to basically start out by putting this within some context and actually starting out with your discussion on the continent of the country of the United States, the continent of North America, of course, with Spanish Florida. And tell us about the Spanish Florida connection in all this.
Well, you should know that as early as the 1500s, the Spanish colonialists had begun to arm Africans. This, as I show in my book on 1776, had profound consequences for the country that became the United States of America, because until approximately about 1820, Spain controlled Florida, and that is to say from the 1500s up until about 1820. And in St. Augustine, Florida, a town that still exists and bills itself as the oldest urban node on the North American continent, from St. Augustine, Florida, the Spanish used to send armed Africans across the border into the Carolinas, particularly South Carolina, which during this time had an unruly African majority. And so you had the specter of armed Spanish troops of ebony hue marauding and pillaging and plundering in South Carolina, oftentimes encouraging the enslaved Africans in South Carolina to join them, which they did more than once. And this helped to instill fear and apprehension in the hearts of the British settlers and helped to create what I refer to as a Black Scare that arguably extends to this very day as the split verdicts on what happened in Ferguson, Missouri over the past few weeks tend to suggest in terms of the division between those who are defined as white and those who are black. So Cuba in particular also was involved in this marauding because in many ways, in some ways, Cuba was the jewel and the crown of the Spanish Empire, perhaps even more so than its competitors, such as Peru or Mexico, for example. But Cuba also overwhelmingly, more so than Mexico or Peru, although they too had populations of African descent, but the percentage in Cuba was generally larger. You should also know that some of the slave revolts that took place in the North American mainland, such as New York City, 1741, if you look closely at the record, the colonial authorities in Manhattan are blaming Cubans of African descent. That is to say, they thought that not only were Afro-Cubans under the Spanish flag marauding and pillaging and plundering in the Carolinas, but they'd also reached Manhattan. You should also know that in 1739, you had the bloodiest revolt of enslaved Africans on the North American mainland, and Stono's revolt in South Carolina. Many of these Africans who revolted were of Angolan heritage. Many of them were speakers of Portuguese, which, as you know, is quite similar to the Spanish language. Many of them practiced the Catholic faith, which had been introduced into Angola by the Portuguese hundreds of years previously. And it is said that after the Africans in South Carolina massacred dozens of settlers, they then began to march towards Spanish Florida, where they planned to hook up with their comrades under the Spanish flag and then perhaps come back with larger brigades and battalions to engage in even more marauding and pillaging and plundering. And so what I'm suggesting is not only was this fixing and fixating in the minds of these settlers in the Carolinas and the North American mainland, this idea of a so-called Black Scare, but it was also introducing the idea of an apprehension and nervousness about Cuba, given its close proximity to the North American mainland. And arguably, that apprehension and nervousness exists to this very day. And certainly, it's fair to suggest that it existed in the fall of 1962, when the planet on which we reside came quite close to a nuclear holocaust, when Cuba and the United States and Cuba's ally in Moscow faced off in what is referred to on this side of the straits as the Cuban Missile Crisis or the October Crisis in Cuba. Yeah. This, too, introduced apprehension about Cuba.
Looking at Spanish Florida and the history that you just described, how then did that impact things in the U.S. when the U.S. then took control of Florida, and clearly there were some differences in the approach of Spain to slavery, considering that some of the black people were armed, as you say, to the United States that had a very stark definition of slavery and the differentiation among the races that came with it, the denigration of black people.
Well, it's very striking. I've come to discover that U.S. patriots and even some of our friends on the left get very nervous, if not infuriated, when you begin to make comparisons between slavery in the United States and slavery elsewhere to the detriment of the United States. Note that I said relative comparisons, because, mm-hmm. of course, they quickly jump to the conclusion if you're saying that Spanish Cuba was a holiday and U.S. slavery was a Holocaust. No, this is a relative comparison.
Right.
It's like saying that apartheid South Africa was worse than post-Jim Crow the United States, which is not to let post-Jim Crow the United States off the hook. It's to make a relative comparison. I mean, it seems to me a very simple concept, and so I think something else is at play. This is the preface to suggesting that when the United States took over Florida approximately 180, 190 years ago, it was a huge defeat for peoples of African descent. I'm afraid it's one of many defeats we've suffered on the North American mainland, because the Spanish were not only more open to arming Africans, and the United States clearly was not, but as well, the Spanish were more open to integrating Africans into the upper reaches of the middle class in terms of the so-called free Negro population, which was viewed with stark suspicion on this side of the Florida Straits. In fact, as we speak, I'm writing a book on the impact of Haiti and Hispaniola and Dominican Republic and the Haitian Revolution on the United States. And that's one of the points that immediately comes clear. When many of the so-called mulattoes start fleeing from Haiti, oftentimes with enslaved Africans in tow, they are not greeted as class comrades on this side of the Florida Straits. They're greeted as racial antagonists. And so when the United States took over Florida, what happened in part was what often happens when the United States seized territory. Texas, for example, California, for example, both seized from Mexico, as you well know. What happens is that the United States pursues this policy of white supremacy, and those who do not fit the category of whiteness are then demoted. And then the floodgates are opened, whereby those who are defined as white then flood into the territory. No better example of that can be found, if I may digress for a second, with regard to the state of Georgia. You know that the indigenous people, or many of the indigenous people, were Cherokee. They sought to assimilate up to and including owning enslaved Africans and dressing like the Europeans, and becoming farmers as opposed to hunter-gatherers. And yet, approximately 180 years ago, they were all expelled. One of the most egregious examples of ethnic cleansing that one can imagine, even though in many ways they had assimilated, because they did not fit the definition of whiteness nor seen as being compatible with white supremacy. And so something similar happened in Florida, because as the United States took over Florida, the population was not that large. And I would estimate, and others have estimated, that the population of African descent in Florida when the United States took over circa 1820 was about 45%. But that quickly dropped. Because what happens, is typical, the floodgates are opened, the huddled masses of Europe are invited over to settle and take land. And you should also know that the Africans of Florida and the indigenous of Florida united as one in one of the most stirring examples of heroism in the history of North America. They fought three glorious wars against the invading U.S. forces, circa 1818, as the United States was prepared to invade, circa 1835, 1836, and circa 1855. This was one of the bloodiest conflicts the United States had ever been involved in, certainly on the soil of the United States before the Civil War. And sadly, these Africans and Seminoles, which is the name we ascribe to the indigenous people, were defeated. Although, strikingly enough, many of the remnants of those defeated populations then migrated to Mexico, where their descendants still reside.
Yeah, and that was actually going to be my next question about the Seminoles and the working together of the Africans and indigenous people. But I also wanted you to talk, because in your book you talk about the case of Antonio Proctor, and as an example, you know, contrasting, I suppose, a Spanish Florida with U.S. rule. Once the U.S. took over.
That case is very similar to some of the Haitian cases I'm writing about. That is to say, where those who would find us free in the Caribbean come to the North American mainland and quickly are subjected to a demotion. Proctor was a man of color in Florida, a man of some means and property, and yet, after the United States took over Florida, shortly thereafter, he found himself and his family on the verge of being enslaved, which is quite a precipitous drop. This, again, is nothing new. In my 1776 book, I talk about a black man by the name of Thomas Jeremiah, who just before July 4th, 1776, when the United States formally revolts against British rule, is executed by the so-called Patriots in North and South Carolina. Even though he's a man of means, even though he was quite game with the supporting enslavement of Africans, but they fabricated the story that that was not the case, that in fact he was going to lead a slave revolt in league with London, and so therefore he was executed. You know, obviously this is very troubling, these kinds of vignettes, and I would also say that it should be studied very closely and carefully today by those who consider themselves to be part of the black middle class, the black upper class, because I'm afraid that progress does not move in a linear fashion. That is to say that it's not unknown for the clock of history to be reversed. I mean, speaking of Haiti once again, slavery was abolished in Haiti, and it tended to hold. But by the U.S. Civil War, there were those in the so-called Confederate States of America who had the idea of re-enslaving Haiti. That was one of the reasons why Haiti had to spend so much money on its military, which helped, I'm afraid, to deform its economy. You also know, I'm sure, that in the other parts of the so-called French West Indies, slavery was abolished. Then it came back in places like Cayenne on the northern coast of South America, Martinique, Guadeloupe, etc. So I guess one of the reasons we study history is so that we can get some sort of guidance for today and the future. And in that regard, I think not only members of the black middle class, but others should be very concerned about this historic pattern of the United States seeking to marginalize and sideline darker-skinned peoples.
Yes, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest is Dr. Gerald Horn, who's joining us for the hour discussing his latest brand new book, yet another brand new book entitled Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. And two things I just wanted to highlight from what you said about the case of Antonio Proctor that you just discussed and others who basically were re-enslaved, who were free, were re-enslaved. So the story of 12 Years a Slave that was so popular in theaters last year isn't that unusual a story. I mean, it happened not only in the north of the United States, but as you said, in Florida and other places. But the other thing, before we leave Spanish Florida per se, and the relationship with Cuba and the U.S., to talk a bit about the slave ship Amistad and the rebellion that happened.
I will be happy to. First of all, footnote, it's not only people like Solomon Northrop who found themselves once free, then enslaved, or Antonio Proctor or Thomas Jeremiah. What's interesting about the United States is the way that blackness is defined. As you know, you can look like Madonna, but if you have the faintest heritage of African descent on your family tree, you're considered to be black. And this was very useful in terms of broadening the base of slavery. And so therefore, it was not unknown for European migrants to sell into a place like New Orleans in the antebellum era, the pre-Civil War era. And they'd get off the ship, and somebody would collar them and say, okay, you're a black person. They said, no, I'm from Ireland. They say, yes, you are. You're not fooling me. And they find themselves on a plantation. I mean, it's quite remarkable. And this, of course, helps to underscore why so many people would come to oppose slavery, because it was expanding beyond the boundaries of those with even the faintest hint of African ancestry. With regard to the slave ship Amistad, it's in the context of the growth of enslavement of Africans on the island in the 1830s and 1840s, although you should also know that shortly after the founding of the United States of America, over two centuries ago, the United States had ousted the Spanish as being the major supplier of Africans, enslaved Africans, to the island of Cuba. What happens on the slave ship Amistad circa 1839, circa 1840, is that African enslaved Africans are being transported by ship from one side of the island to another side of the island. But as so often happens, a shipboard insurrection takes place. These were quite common and quite frequent during the era of slavery, whereby the Africans basically take over. Indeed, in my 1776 book, I talk about Africans taking over shortly after leaving the coast of Africa and then sailing back to the African coast and then enslaving the Europeans for a while. It'll show them how it feels. In any case, after the Africans take over the slave ship Amistad, which, as you know, was then turned into a movie directed by Steven Spielberg a few years ago, they tried to steer the ship away from Cuba, perhaps to Africa, certainly away from Cuba, the United States, but they're trusting, apparently, of a crew member who survives, who manages to sell the ship to the North American mainland, winding up in Connecticut, where then what ensues is this trial of the Africans. And what ensues, of course, is that the Africans win the trial, not least, it should be said in all fairness, because of growing abolitionist sentiment in the state of Connecticut. And what happens is that the Africans, or at least many of them, are allowed to go back to West Africa, where presumably their descendants continue to reside.
Again, our guest is Dr. Gerald Horner, discussing race, the revolution, the United States and Cuba during slavery and Jim Crow. So then the Texas-Cuba slave trade connection, because you have written about in other instances about an illegal slave trade going on. I mean, there was the legal slave trade and then an illegal slave trade. But tell us about the Texas-Cuba connection, because there was quite a commerce happening there.
Well, those who are familiar with the United States know that Texas is the citadel of reaction, the fortress of conservatism, the fortress of reactionary politics. And this is nothing new. A lot of it has to do with how Texas became a state. That is to say, you had these Euro-Americans who revolted against Mexican rule in 1836, not least because Mexico had been moving towards abolition of slavery. Mexico had a president of partial African descent, Vicente Guerrero, 180 years before Barack Obama. So rather than accede, they seceded from Mexico, setting up the Republic of Texas. And what's striking is that the Republic of Texas, they have a very small population of European descent. The Republic of Texas under the Lone Star flag, in many ways, it was just a slave trading emporium. That seemed to be their major preoccupation and their major business. In previous books, I've talked about how slave ships with the Republic of Texas flag were oftentimes found off the coast of Africa, oftentimes found off the coast of Brazil, because at the same time, in the 1830s and 1840s, U.S. nationals and Texians, as they were called, were coming into the leadership of the slave trade into Brazil, for example, which is the largest black population outside of Nigeria. And so what happens is that the Texas slave traders see an enormous commercial opportunity in supplying Africans to Cuba. That's why I suggest that in light of the fact that U.S. slave traders and Texas slave traders were notorious for breaking up families, selling the daughter, but not necessarily the son, that it is hardly possible that U.S. nationals, black Americans of today, have relatives in Cuba without knowing it, because thousands upon thousands of Africans were traded back and forth from Galveston, Texas, which, by the way, is not only the home of Barry White, the silken crooner, but also Jack Johnson, the heavyweight boxing champion of over a century ago. And in all fairness, I should mention that Pensacola, Florida, also became a slave trading site. That is, Africans being traded from Pensacola into Cuba as well. I should mention in this context that what's remarkable about this slave trade as well is not only the participation of the so-called Republic of Texas, but also the United States itself, as evidenced by the participation of Pensacola, Florida. In fact, U.S. diplomats, it seemed to be, they spent more time trading Africans than attending to the diplomatic business of the United States of America, one of whom was Nicholas Tris, who I go on at some length about, who had a familiar relationship to Thomas Jefferson himself and was excoriated in the abolitionist press, even excoriated in the Spanish press, because one of the contradictions that quickly emerged between Texas and the United States on the one hand and the Spanish colonialists on the other was that Spain had a justifiable apprehension that the United States wanted to take over Cuba, or that Texas wanted to take over Cuba.
Yeah.
And then also by bringing so many Africans to Cuba, Madrid, or at least some in Spanish Cuba, felt that they were creating a twin to Haiti. That was always the fear. A word has disappeared from the lexicon that was used quite frequently then, which is Africanization.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, the fear that Cuba was absorbing too many Africans, and that was leading to a demographic tipping point, which would create fertile grounds for a Haitian revolution. And this was a regnant fear in the 19th century.
In your book, you talk about the numbers. First of all, that the flag, the single star, the lone star on the flags of Cuba and of Texas perhaps was not accidental. And also just the numbers of people, like 15 of people who were enslaved, as high as 15,000 in a single year, and also how the slave trade with Texas actually increased the price of those who were enslaved. I mean, the price was higher because of the demand coming from Texas.
Well, of course, these enslaved Africans in Cuba, they're involved in growing tobacco, sugar, of course. The aphorism of that era is that sugar is made with blood, because it was a very brutal business. Coffee, of course. They're very busy. And they're also very busy in fomenting slave revolts. That needs to be said as well, because as Africanization begins to take hold, history also takes hold, which is that when you get more Africans, you're running the risk, if you're a slave owner, of losing your life, because the Africans gain confidence and tend to revolt, and that happens in Cuba more than once. And you should also know that these slave revolts in Cuba receive maximum support on this side of the Florida Straits. Martin Delaney, who's probably second only to Frederick Douglass in the esteemed category of being a black abolitionist, wrote a novel which I would suggest to this very day is perhaps the leading novel in the entire corpus of African-American literature, entitled Blake, which deals with slave restiveness in Cuba and suggests with some foresight and prescience that ultimately it would be the Cubans, particularly the rebellious Africans in Cuba, who would be leading all of us in the hemisphere to a new stage in humanity. And arguably, in some ways, Martin Delaney in the 1850s anticipated the Cuban Revolution of 1959, which of course led to Cuban soldiers going to Angola to defeat the apartheid regime, and Cuban doctors being spread throughout the Caribbean and helping to save lives, and also to Brazil. So I think one of the most honorable chapters in African American history is this international solidarity, particularly with the enslaved of Cuba.
Tell us about the Ostend Manifesto.
Well, as I said, the United States was hungering for Cuba, which is not a new development. And the United States, what you need to realize, you need to put this in the context of so-called sectional politics, that is to say, the struggle between the North and the South that explodes in Civil War in 1861 to 1865. And so there was this desire on the part of the South to take Cuba and then convert it either into one slave state or three slave states, so that then more senators and congresspersons from Dixie could descend upon Washington and turn the United States even more so into a state that had as its foremost objective defending slavery. So the Ostend Manifesto was written in 1844, described a rationale for the United States to purchase Cuba from Spain. Of course, Spain was not interested in selling Cuba, and which leads, of course, to the idea that what should happen is that if Spain was not interested in selling Cuba to the United States, like Russia sold Alaska to the United States circa 1867, or how the United States overthrew the Hawaii Kingdom in the 1890s and incorporated Hawaii, and next to Hawaii, the United States failed to annex the island of Hispaniola, absorbing Haiti and Dominican Republic circa 1870-1871, then the United States informally should take over Cuba. By informally, what I mean is looking the other way, as what we're called filibusterers, or actually are adventurers and soldiers of fortune and freebooters, so-called privatized military intervention would descend upon Cuba and oust the Spanish colonialists and take over and then eventually incorporate Cuba into the United States. And in some ways, it's like the Bay of Pigs invasion that happens in the early stages of the JFK administration in the 1960s, although, of course, that involved the direct CIA complicity. Yeah. But it wasn't the U.S. military per se that was involved in that particular invasion of Cuba to overthrow the Castro regime. So the Bay of Pigs invasion, in a sense, had a historical precedent. You should also know, of course, that this was a trademark of U.S. foreign policy. I'm sure some of the listeners know about the film Walker, which came out a few years ago, which dramatizes the adventurer and freebooter William Walker in circa 1857 invades Nicaragua and oust the leadership, takes over Nicaragua for a while, tries to reestablish slavery in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
Well, this is the trademark of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America during that era.
Right. On that note, Dr. Horn, we are going to have to take our station break, and we are going to continue our conversation with you about your brand new book, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
De Arrocero voy para Marcané, llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarín. De Arrocero voy para Marcané, llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarín. De Arrocero voy para Marcané, llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarín.
Welcome back. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're doing a one-hour special with Dr. Gerald Horn about his brand new book, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. And this book is the latest of Dr. Horn, a very prolific historian and path-breaking in his analysis and what he brings out. And I'd like to share with our listeners what Tom Hayden had to say about Dr. Horn's new book. Quote, Gerald Horn's epic history will help many readers understand the special relationship between slavery, African Americans, and Cuba over the centuries. Horn continues in the deep tradition of Frederick Douglass, who described Cuba as, quote, the great Western slave mart of the world. Horn is in the forefront of historians laboring to revise the entire story of the Americas until the broken pieces are mended. Dr. Horn, I really love that, revising the entire story of the Americas, because certainly if you look at your body of work, that is exactly what you, more so than any other historian that I have heard of, are doing. So, Dr. Horn, welcome back after station break. And we are now going to return to our discussion about your brand new book. And we are going to fast forward it a bit. It's amazing just how time flies with these kinds of fascinating discussions. But Cuba, so we talked about the fear of the Africanization and the U.S. Really having its sights on annexing Cuba. Also, the impact of the Cuban Revolution, the Haitian Revolution on Cuba and throughout the region, actually, in the Americas. Perhaps we could just touch on that a little bit before we fast forward then to Jim Crow being enforced in Cuba.
Well, I have to say I'm writing a book about Hispaniola, which includes Haiti and the Dominican Republic as we speak, and so my mind is overflowing with Haiti and Dominican Republic. Yeah. But what's remarkable about Haiti, and this is my thesis of the book, is that the Haitian Revolution basically marks a crisis, a general crisis of the slave system that only could be resolved with its collapse. In other words, number one, when the Africans in Haiti and in Hispaniola revolted, it basically upset the chessboard. It allowed Haiti to then ally intermittently with London against the United States, which puts pressure on the United States, or ally with London against Paris and Spain, which puts pressure on the Spanish and Cuba. The Haitians sent envoys, and I put that term in quotation marks, others might call them professional revolutionaries, throughout the region, to Jamaica, to Venezuela, even the United States. Because one of the points I'm going to show in this book is that if you look at the leading slave revolts in the North American mainland, Nat Turner, circa 1831, Denmark Vesey, circa 1822, Gabriel's revolt in Virginia, circa 1800, they all have Haitian fingerprints all over them. And so the very name Haiti sent a shudder through the bones of slave owners throughout the Americas. And it led to a crisis of the slave system that ultimately eventuated in civil war and the destruction of slavery in the United States, and ultimately the destruction of slavery in Cuba, which happens belatedly in the 1880s. But getting back to Cuba, what's striking about Cuba, as opposed to the United States, is that in Cuba, there was a parallel, there was a congruence between the struggle against slavery and the struggle against colonialism, as embodied in the figure Antonio Maceo, a national hero of Cuba, who, of course, is of African descent. And, of course, many African Americans to this very day carry the name Maceo, including James Brown's sideman, if you'll recall. But in the United States, the struggle against slavery in the 1770s and the struggle against British colonialism were at odds, because the leaders of the struggle against British colonialism, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Patrick Henry, they're all slave owners. And they are fearful that Britain is going to abolish slavery. And I think that if you understand and tease out the consequences of that kernel, you'll be able to understand why people of African descent have had such a hard road to hoe on the North American mainland to this very day, up to and including the tragic events in Ferguson, Missouri of August 2014. So when Haiti revolted against slavery, it had a most dramatic impact on neighboring Cuba, not least because Haitian slave owners, many of them fled to Cuba, just like many of them fled to Louisiana to strengthen slavery in New Orleans. But as well, the Haitians were trying to stir up things in Cuba, which eventually led to the abolition of slavery in the 1880s.
Yeah, and I was quite struck, too, that you talked about the revolt that happened in St. Lucia, that little Caribbean island of St. Lucia, English-speaking, but they do speak a form of Creole, back in 1849, and that they were chanting the name of one of the leaders of the Haitian Revolution. Dr. Horn.
That was not unusual. That was not unusual at all. For example, during the height of the revolt on Hispaniola against colonial rule, say in the 1790s, you had Africans in Venezuela, for example, who said that they were trying to emulate Hispaniola. You may be familiar with Fedon's revolt in Grenada that takes place in the 1790s, which is deeply influenced by the Haitian Revolution. So, as I said, everybody in America, whether of African descent or not, but certainly those of African descent, owe a debt of gratitude to the Haitian Revolution, because I think there's a direct connection between Haiti's activism of the 19th century and how it has been punished so severely since that time. Because, of course, our oppressors, our antagonists, they have very long memories. And they feel that if they can pulverize the Haitians sufficiently, then the rest of us will also be rather reluctant to get involved in any kind of revolt to this very day.
Yeah, and so that brings us to, you have a chapter of the book, Race, War in Cuba, but also we're going to kind of put a few things together quickly. I'm looking at the clock. We have about 9 minutes left. I can't believe how the time has flown. About Jim Crow being enforced in Cuba, but also the presence of Africans and rebellious Africans in Cuba and leading up to and in part making possible the success of the Cuban Revolution. Dr. Horn.
Well, first of all, as noted, the struggle against slavery and the struggle of against colonialism tended to merge. Eventually, what happens is that the Spanish and the Cubans, particularly the Cubans of African descent, basically pound each other into submission, and then appears on the scene the United States of America circa 1898 to claim Cuba, and the Cubans and the Spanish, in some ways, are too weak to resist because they had sort of punched each other into submission. That begins the era from 1898 to 1959 of U.S. neocolonial rule. And what comes with U.S. neocolonial rule was an attempted forcible implantation of the kind of noxious Jim Crow that obtained on the U.S. mainland. Now, to repeat, and as noted, Cuba was no holiday under the Spanish, but certainly the kind of rigid Jim Crow that the United States tried to implant was a divergence in terms of Cuban history. It led to numerous revolts, and indeed, part of the thesis of my book is that the United States helped to accelerate a revolutionary process in Cuba by seeking to forcibly implant Jim Crow. With regard to the so-called race war that takes place in Cuba about 1912, May-June 1912, that has been examined quite extensively by historians of Cuba and Cuban historians as well, particularly in the centennial year of 2012, not so long ago. I think what I bring to the table with regard to that narrative, and I think if I must say so myself, is an important missing piece of the puzzle, is that it's the United States that was in control of Cuba in a de facto and a real sense in 1912. And if you look closely at the record, what you'll find is that it is the United States that is objecting to restiveness and rebelliousness on the part of Africans. They think they're becoming too big for their britches, not least because they're revolting against U.S.-style Jim Crow. And it's the United States that helps to finance and subsidize the race war, which by the way, sends a signal to the mainland, to the rest of Africans, which is one of the reasons why, if you look at the Negro press, they're very upset. That is to say, the U.S. Negro press. They're very upset about what's going on in Cuba, and they see it, justifiably and understandably, as a signal to themselves as to what can befall them, because thousands of Africans were massacred on the island circa 1912. But one of the points that I think you alluded to that I should also mention is that the forcible implantation of Jim Crow also radicalizes a number of the Afro-Cubans, leading to the fact that the leaders of the radical movement, including the Communist Party in Cuba pre-1959, were disproportionately of African descent, to the point where the Pittsburgh Courier, a leading Negro paper, predicted over 70-odd years ago that Cuba would be the first socialist state in the hemisphere. This was before 1959. This was before the attack on the Mikado barracks in 1953, led by the Castro brothers. In other words, you should not see the Cuban Revolution as something that comes out of the blue, so to speak, or all of a sudden with the Castro brothers. It has a long prehistory.
Dr. Horn, you have talked, I mean, we've, in the last few minutes here that we have, you certainly have talked on this show on Sojourner Truth and also in your talk that you gave on 1776 about the lack of international perspective of the civil rights, the so-named black civil rights leaders that we see today. And contrasting that in a way with looking at previous generations that had a much more international view. And you look at leaders like Charles Hamilton Houston, who was a mentor to Thurgood Marshall. You look at James Weldon Johnson, who also spoke Spanish fluently. Of course, Frederick Douglass had that international view. And then a whole slew of black communists that people don't like to talk about, such as Howard Johnson and also the leader of the National Maritime Union, who was from Jamaica, hailed from the island of Jamaica, a man of African descent. So talk then about that contrast, because those are examples of people that did have an international view that somehow seems to be lost today.
Well, I think it may be lost, number one, because in the 19th century, since so many of us were human chattel or property, we were looking for allies to escape that horrible condition. And most of the allies overwhelmingly could be found overseas, and that led to a certain kind of internationalism, not least because the antagonists of the United States, not least in London, or to a degree in Paris, were willing to ally with us to destabilize Washington. As a matter of fact, August 2014 marks the 200th anniversary of the burning of Washington, D.C. by the British Redcoats, who did that in league with enslaved Africans in the nation's capital, who the Africans, of course, got an early form of reparations by plundering the White House of its silverware. The second point is that since this erosion of Jim Crow, part of the bargain was that the black leadership would break ties with the international community and become sort of a normalized U.S. citizens. That is to say, our foreign policy would be conducted through the State Department like other U.S. citizens. And that was the trade-off. You get a form of anti-Jim Crow concessions, and in return, you drop internationalism. Those who don't, Martin Luther King speaking against the Vietnam War, or Malcolm X, or Paul Robeson with his We Charge Genocide petition, William Patterson, who he worked with, that is to say, Robeson worked with, or punished, you know, jailed, income drops precipitously, murdered in the case of Martin Luther King. The problem is that the United States is turning more to the right, and as the polls on Ferguson, Missouri suggest, I'm afraid that many of our friends in the Euro-American community are not alongside us on that struggle, whereas the international community is. And so it seems that we're faced with a stark choice, that if we really want justice, we have to follow the logic of our ancestors. Whereas if we want to engage in a phony war, I guess we should just keep on doing what we have been doing, which quite frankly is leading us to the precipice of disaster.
Dr. Horn, just with this book, with your book on the counter-revolution of 1776, as we said earlier, it really is part of an entire body of work, which we really do owe you a great debt, because very few people are doing that work and are certainly doing it with the thoroughness that you are consistently doing. And in reading of the background of the book, you had to do extensive research in Havana, Cuba, in Madrid, in London, and across the United States to really bring this information to us. But I wanted you to just say a little bit about why you're doing this work, about why this work is so important and central to everything that we're facing today.
Well, when you go to a doctor, one of the first thing a doctor does when he or she examines you is to get a medical history, not only your medical history, but those of your father and mother, and sometimes uncles and cousins, because that is seen as necessary for making an adequate diagnosis. Likewise, with regard to social science, I don't think that we can have an adequate diagnosis of the problems in the United States and how to propose remedies, like a doctor proposes remedies, unless we have an adequate history. And if history tells us that, for example, with regard to people of African descent, that other than our struggles that we launch ourselves, that our alliances with the international community has been our saving grace, well, then we should take that history very seriously, and perhaps it should inform our diagnosis and our prescription for a remedy going forward. And if we choose to ignore that history, then we should not be surprised if our diagnosis and our remedies tend to fail. I think it's a very simple equation, and I think that's what's driving and motivating myself on a personal level.
Yeah, and ironically, just at the very end of your book, you rightly point out that there may be less contact between Africans in Cuba and Africans even in Florida, much less the rest of the United States, than they had been, you know, really now 2 centuries ago. I mean, we're talking about the 19th century. Here we are in the 21st century, Dr. Horn.
Well, that's certainly true, and a lot of it has to do with this illegal blockade of Cuba, which the United States is virtually isolated on, and which the progressive community should see its elimination as a prime demand. And Cuba, of course, is being punished, not least from breaking away from the U.S. neocolonialism, but also because of its role in helping to defeat apartheid. In fact, I should add, before we close, that one of the many reasons why I wrote this book and focusing on the Cubans of African descent, is I think it would be very important to the reparations movement in the United States of America, where descendants of enslaved Africans, not to mention descendants of enslaved Africans in the Caribbean, are seeking reparations for generations of unpaid labor. We need to enlist the Cubans on our side, and they have a particular bone to pick with Uncle Sam. And it recalls what I know about the struggles in Southern Africa when the Cuban authorities said that after they walked into the negotiating room alongside the Angolans and the South Africans and the Namibians, you could tell that the apartheid authorities almost froze in their tracks. They got nervous, as well they should. I'd like to see the Cubans walk into the negotiating room when we have negotiations about reparations, because I dare say that the U.S. authorities would no doubt freeze in their tracks.
Well, on that note, Dr. Gerald Horn, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. Ishmael Reed, a MacArthur Fellow, says, Gerald Horn is one of our most original historians. I could not agree more. Dr. Horn, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
We are out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team and our assistant producer, our engineer also, and all who helped to make today's show possible. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Remember to follow us on Twitter. Look for So True KPFK and look for us on Facebook at Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott, where you can check out breaking news, listen to shows, see photos, messages, and more, and check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. Thank you for listening. Today's show, of course, was pre-recorded. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.